You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Well, it's been 40 years since Martin Luther King Jr. stood on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. and delivered the now famous I Have a Dream speech. A year before his assassination, Dr. King spoke out against the war in Vietnam. Today, Martin Luther King III spoke to Peace Watch to announce the kickoff of the 40th anniversary commemoration of the March on Washington and to call for mobilization against the buildup of military spending, the loss of civil liberties, and the decrease of funding for social programs.
The issues of poverty, racism and militarism and violence, issues that Martin Luther King Jr. addressed 40 years ago. We realize that today there are nearly 14 million people who are living in poverty, and 3 or 4 million of those who are homeless. We realize that in 30 months, almost 3 million people have lost jobs in this country. With all of this wealth that exists, we realize that while racism is not like it was in 1963, it still is very real when we have an administration that is trying to dismantle affirmative action. We realize that militarism seems to be the order of the day. We've already spent, or nearly spent, $100 billion to go in and destroy Iraq, and we're going to spend $100 to $200 billion to rebuild it. And yet, Medicaid, Medicare, aid to families with dependent children, or Head Start, college grants, all of that is being cut. So all the programs of social uplift are being cut, and the only thing we're doing is spending money on death and destruction. It seems to me that American people must say, if we're going to spend $300+ billion on death and destruction, we ought to, at a minimum, spend at least the same amount for life and the preservation of life. And so we are encouraging women and men and families to come to Washington on August 23rd to demonstrate, to protest. This is not just to acknowledge our past, but to build on to our future. We are returning to Washington. We want to repair the damage that has been done, and then we have renewed spirits. So we're returning, repairing, and we are renewed.
Last year, the world spent $784 billion on arms, up from $714 billion the previous year. Tomorrow, we will continue our conversation with Martin Luther King III and the upcoming event, August 23rd.
She killed a man who thought that she was fair game. When I heard the news, I screamed inside. Lost all my cool, I could not hide. 'Cause now Joanne is you, and Joanne is me. Our prison is the whole society. No, we live in a land of bringing pressure to bear.
The title of that song, Joanne Little, by Bernice Johnson Regan. Every few months, the armed forces is rocked by accounts of sexual violence. Peace Watch correspondent Ingrid Drake spoke recently with Dorothy Mackey, who founded Survivors Take Action Against Abuse by Military Personnel, or STAMP, after 9 years of service in the Air Force. Dorothy entered the Air Force from a junior ROTC program, advanced through the ranks to become a commander, and was often recognized for her military and community service. But during her tenure, she was sexually assaulted 3 times, as well as emotionally terrorized by her supervising colonel. None of her assailants were ever prosecuted. Dorothy began by discussing the events leading up to her decision to leave her career in the military.
In my last year of service, I worked directly for a full colonel. His title was Inspector General, which is the military internal complaint system, at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Ohio, which had a $20 billion annual budget. I watched this man, this Inspector General, whose name is Colonel Milam, and his assistant, Lieutenant Colonel Elmore, as they misappropriated government funds. They misused civilian training money for a golf outing. They were extremely bigoted and prejudiced in that they did nothing as far as domestic violence cases or even child endangerment cases. as I attempted to hold them accountable and make sure they did right by everybody, even the military members, they started pretty much, I would call tag team assaulting me. It went on for a year where it was groping, grabbing, sexual inappropriate behavior, humiliating me both publicly and privately, and I really couldn't exist in it anymore, and my health was deteriorating, and psychologically that was really being impinged and could not find help. Everybody I went to pretty much told me to go away or handle it on my own, and I ended up leaving my career, and then I took a lawsuit against the individuals. The Justice Department and senators, congressmen, you name it, I went to them, the state of Ohio, where I live and where it happened, went to prosecutors, civilian prosecutors, no one would touch it, went to the Justice Department three times, they refused to help me. Now, these are the prosecutors of America. I got an attorney who we sued them civilly, and much to my dismay, we actually did get into the court, which was great. But the Justice Department stepped in to represent my assailants against me in a court of law. And during 1994 to 98, I learned of five laws on the U.S. books that give absolute immunity to U.S. military members who rape, maim, or murder their own or others. And when we got to the Supreme Court level, the Supreme Court refused to hear my case, thereby giving Milam and Elmore immunity from being held accountable. We then countersued the United States government, and they themselves gave themselves immunity based on the same five laws. You know, you really have to go back to the premise, the basic foundation here. The United States military, in the eyes of the Americans, are here to defend and protect their civilian constitutional rights, okay, and all of our rights. And yet, it's quite ironic when military members themselves have no rights. As soon as they sign on a dotted line, they can be forced to take smallpox vaccines, they can be experimented on as far as the 1947 atomic vets proved, in which they were radiated purposely by the United States government. They can pretty much do whatever they want. The irony is that if you understand that your own military members that are fighting and supporting and protecting your constitutional rights do not have any rights, then how is it that any American can believe they fully, truly have rights? They don't. You can't. In looking back at what I was asked to do as I was moving through my own professional career, I was being asked on a regular, ongoing basis, not necessarily verbally, but nonverbally, in the actions that my leadership wanted me to take, to look the other way when there were legal issues happen, either the misappropriation of government funds or literally simply allowing aircraft which were clearly in violation and would put military members and our own national security at risk when aircraft were not working appropriately, and I couldn't do it. And I was not willing to jeopardize my own personal integrity for any rank or promotion within the system. But the sad truth of it is that I was probably the exception rather than the rule when it came down to it. And there are other people out there like me. There's a lot of good military members that are losing their careers when they're standing up to corruption and abuse inside the system.
Could you please tell us, why did you join the armed forces?
I really wanted to put all of my knowledge and all of my skills to test. Here was an institution, the United States military, that by its own public relations advocated for equal opportunity, no gender bias, no prejudicial type of system, honor, integrity, great rules. I wanted to see if simply based on my intellect, my physical strength and abilities, if I could contribute to, as the military put out, deterring war. And I rose to that challenge. In fact, in many situations, I exceeded those challenges. And yet, that wasn't what it was really about.
Could you also explain to us why you chose to stay in the military after you had experienced sexual assault by those within the service?
Often when you are traumatized, you're not acting from a normal place of reason anyway. And yet, you're also confronted with a system which has absolutely promised you that it will take appropriate action. And what happens is there's this battle, if you will, for trying to find a safe place to go, and that wasn't there. What I found happened is that after each assault, and I would attempt to find responsible, honorable, safe place to go and talk about what happened, it came very clear very quickly through my instinct that that wasn't going to happen to me. I think what was my catalyst is one day having this epiphany, if you will, that I could not live in fear for the rest of my life. And I was literally, it was my fear that really drove me to take action. And it was I don't want to minimize it. It was a fear that kept me in corners. I had flashbacks for 5 years. And yet I struggled through those and refused to be captured by those, knowing that the military, that these guys who assaulted me, that they were not only, even though I sued them and even though they got immunity, they got their retirement. They went on to extremely good paying jobs, and yet they left me in the dust. And I knew the military and the VA, who is in part a party to the system, wanted to keep me quiet. They didn't care if I committed suicide. They didn't care if I killed somebody else. They didn't care if they made me crazy, and they didn't care if I was an angry human being. Because in our society, if you are one of those type of people, our society won't listen to you. I had moments of anger. I had moments of crazed indifference, because part of it is a crazy-making system. I wasn't crazy. It was.
Can you talk a little bit about how it's more difficult to be in the military and accuse your fellow military personnel than maybe in other parts of society?
Whoever you are and wherever you may be in being assaulted, whether or not you're a child in school, a college student, a member of a church and your clergy assaults you, that assault or rape is absolutely abhorrent. It is traumatizing to a level which is anguishing. However, when you are in the military, the first lie that's set up is that military members are trained to absolutely believe, much like how a child is taught to believe in parents. And yet the military takes it even a step further, that you must depend and believe fully in the people around you with your life, because if you go into battle, your life will be in their hands, their life will be in your hands. And that sets up the big falsity. And that is that when you start to work with these people, you virtually let go of your internal instincts, your internal understanding. So when you are assaulted, when it has happened, and it's estimated that over 200,000 American military women have been harassed and or assaulted, it's estimated out of those numbers that 30% of all women in the military have been raped or abused. In 1991 to 92, Tailhook scandal happened, in which Paula Coughlin was one of 83 women who were forced through a gauntlet of men who were groped, grabbed, bruised. Many of their clothes were ripped off of them, and she was the only one that was put on national TV, in which she was virtually accused of becoming the problem in the Navy. These were the good old boys, and it had happened for many times. And how dare you interfere with our fun, even though she was also a naval aviator and have every right to be at a conference. It was supposed to be a business conference. After that, Paula Coughlin tried to stay in the Navy, and the Navy brought up a zero-tolerance policy, that this would not happen, or that was the presumption of what it meant to all Americans as well as the military members. The reality is that Paula Coughlin had death threats put against her, and she left the military under death threats. She knew she could no longer be a part of it. You have then the McDowell report, and the McDowell report was an Air Force officer of the criminal investigative side, which is the equivalent of the FBI. In each one of the services, you have a criminal investigative system. McDowell, Lieutenant Colonel McDowell, was a member of the Air Force, and he was known as the expert to talk about rape, to talk to rape victims. But McDowell's premise was that 60% of all reports were false. Now, this is contrary to the FBI, who said that nationally only 8% of all reports, claims of rape or assault, are false reports. McDowell also went on to set up a questionnaire in which he would give the victims a point for every positive or affirmed answer. And within those, he would ask questions such as, did your assailant wear a mask? Did they have a sharp weapon? If it was positive, the victim would get points. Then he would ask questions which were not typical of asking victims. Did the victim have psychological or financial problems? And when you looked at McDowell's scoring system, the scoring system was that you as a victim had to score below a zero to be considered telling the truth. Now that is virtually impossible to do based on the questions that McDowell asked. In addition to that, McDowell was not only just the Air Force's expert, but he was sanctioned by the Department of Defense, in which he also trained all the other military services. The problem with that is that you have a zero-tolerance policy, which then with McDowell's information out there was not about, we don't want these to happen, we simply don't want any complaining people to come forward. So is it easy to complain in the military? Absolutely not, because often what they will do is, if you're a woman, they will say you're a lesbian. They will try to put you, if you're a man or a woman, they will attempt to put you in the psych ward and give you drugs, hallucinogenic drugs against your will, and then write you off as a psychotic or a problem child, or that you have personality disorders. Air Force active duty or military active duty people that I've talked to, and I've had over 3,800 cases, I've heard everything from they've charged women, the victims, with adultery or fraternization. And they've often charged the men who are actually rapists, if there's enough pressure to be brought against them, they've charged them with adultery or fraternization. Now, what does this mean when a rapist is being charged? Well, the problem is that when they leave the military, and they may be your neighbors, they may have punishment against them when they're in fact a rapist, but it looks like it was only an adultery charge. This has been going on throughout all the military services across the board and is showing up in the current Air Force Academy rape case. There are over 320 sexual assaults since 1996, even though the Air Force leadership is wanting to say there's only 56 women, and yet they found that there were 24 men, also male cadets at least, that were sexually assaulted in this past year. And we're not talking that these young men were gay men. We're talking that they were, many of them, the majority of them are probably heterosexual. That is one of the big lies in our country, is that most men who are raped are actually raped by other heterosexual men, 98% of them. It is actually very rare where gay men will rape other gays, but it is not unusual for heterosexual men to be raping heterosexual men. It's about power and control. And yet even the Air Force leadership is not discussing it.
And can you please talk a little bit about how race and class also intersect with gender in this whole mix?
If you go back and look at the Aberdeen Proving Ground sexual scandal, where there was at least a dozen women who said that they had been raped, and during the investigation, they were clearly indicating that middle managers, known as NCOs, were taking young women, recruits, off of the base to rape them. And yet, when it came down to it, the only one who was actually found guilty and then sent to prison was an African-American man. There are aspects of the military that I believe is pitting minorities and genders against each other, that often it will be minority males who go to jail, or even some of the, if they are whites that go to jail, they may go to jail because they are not the insiders, and they will become the scapegoats. When you keep looking at all these sexual scandals, and I'm talking from Tailhook, none of the senior leadership was responsible. But if you look at the 12-year-old Okinawan who was raped by three military members, all minority men, and yet the admiral, Admiral Mackey, said they should have used a prostitute. Now, let me bring this very clearly. Within the military, admirals and generals are not just CEOs. They are considered almost godlike. That when they speak, everybody jumps. As soon as a general or an admiral walks into the room, you stand up, you salute, and yet when this admiral, Admiral Mackey, said they should have used a prostitute, number one, prostitution is illegal both federally in the United States and in the military rule books. And then he also was sanctioning the beating almost nearly to death of another human being and the gang rape of another human being. In his mind, he had not only no problem with using prostitutes in that kind of way, but that he really didn't even worry about that child, and yet he was simply retired. You can see this in multiple cases with the Sergeant Major McKinney from the Army, who was initially charged with five different types of assaults and harassment in which five different women from throughout the military where he'd been stationed, he had done things such as rape. He actually went on Brian Gumbel Live at the time and said that he was aware, he, McKinney, was aware of 22 general officers who did equal or worse than him. Now, the interesting thing about that is that McKinney was virtually blackmailing the United States Army. He was telling them that if you try to come after me, I will make sure that those 22 general officers' names are known. Mm-hmm. McKinney only was charged with tampering with evidence. None of the 22 general officers were ever investigated. Nothing ever came of that. This is pretty common, and that's the sad thing, is that the military is turning loose a whole lot of people without holding them fully accountable into the civilian public.
Is it that these men who are attracted into military service are somehow more violent, or, you know, or is it a process within the armed services, or is it just a reflection of society in general?
I think it's a combination of both. Number one, a lot of people who go into the military go in with the right understanding. They often want boundaries. They may be going in because they did not come from the best home life, so they're wanting to really improve their own personal lives and to really be honorable. And yet, if when you have a system that taps into that dysfunctionality, as noted in Lieutenant Colonel David Grossman's book on killing, it talks about how the military has literally become much more aggressive in its training. What happens is that when you tap into people who are looking for boundaries, they don't know boundaries, and yet you are allowing them to overstep more common human boundaries, even to dismiss what we understand as appropriate behavior, both internationally, overseas, and how you treat people that are supposed to be like hosting you as an American. And we've seen this throughout Okinawa and Korea, the Asian nations more dramatically, in the Philippines as well, in which violent crimes have occurred, and it was often the military's normal process in which within 24 hours of either a woman being raped or even a child being murdered, it was common practice up until recently that the military member would simply be put on an airplane and sent to a new location, a new reassignment. They were never charged or held accountable for those assaults. So when you allow that kind of behavior, and then you have five laws on the books, and these are on our legislative books as civilians, that military members get immunity for the rape or maiming or murdering of their own or others, meaning civilians, that when there are precedence cases on our legislative books, that pretty much opens it up for a whole lot of things to happen. And the frightening part of it is that military members must have a sound grounding of what is acceptable behavior and not. Because when you go as a military member overseas and you are in a war zone and you have innocent men and women and children who've been brutalized by a dictator or some type of brutality has befallen them, you don't want your people to then, the protectors, to then become their next level of abusers. And that, in fact, is what is happening.
Have you heard cases coming out of Iraq?
I'm waiting for them to come out of Iraq. They've come out of every other place that America's ever been. I do not anticipate anything different here. You know, I was told that there were probably well over 200 rapes in the previous Gulf War, and those were only of service women, at least. Are they happening to the locals? No doubt. But who's going to listen to them, and who's going to advocate for them?
Could you please share with us some of the recommendations that you have compiled?
Sure. I am actually calling for a public congressional hearing in which not only the abuses at the Air Force Academy, but all the academies. West Point and Annapolis is having the same problems. The Coast Guard Academy is having the same problems of rape and assault, but all the military services. The next would be a call for an independent investigative agency, which I believe would not cost the taxpayers a thing. The way you do that is it would be established as an outside agency. You would virtually strip the military of looking into its own domestic violence or brutality cases, rape cases, those things. Take all their monies that they would normally get for assisting in those type of positions and shift it to an independent investigative agency with military members, former military, who've become true outspoken advocates as well as advocates in the fields of both domestic violence, rape crisis, those types. This would consist of an investigative branch, a prosecution branch. They would also consist of a lab, because we have found that many of the rape or domestic violence incidents happening are being tainted or evidence is being lost, and it's no coincidence that it's being lost. We would also want competent doctors and nurses as well as therapists to assist the entire gamut of prosecution as well as accountability, and that the military would have to allow all access, or anyone who stands in the way of access would be then criminally prosecuted and potentially indicted. I'm also calling for a team of special prosecutors. Again, true advocates, not Washington, D.C. insiders, but those who have shown an advocacy level and willingness to hold people accountable. We're looking at one person, for instance, like Linda Farstein, who is a former DA of New York who had 30 years of prosecuting sexual predators. She would be on that list. I've talked to her and she's agreed, as well as people who have both constitutional law and military law, and again, who are outstanding advocates for significant change. That's just a few. I mean, I have 12 pages of recommendations.
And how can people get in touch with you?
They can check on the website, which is staaamp.org. Or if they're interested, please get a hold of their congressmen and senators. We need everybody's voice because, again, one of the things I've also found out is that there are many military members who have come out of the military who've gone on to be the most prolific serial killers and rapists of our time in the civilian society, such as Jeffrey Dahmer, Berkowitz, DeSalvo, Yates, Ridgway, the killer of Polly Klass. This is, in my opinion, no coincidence. It is affecting all of us. And if we cannot ensure military members' security, then we cannot ensure community, national, or global security.
Dorothy Mackey is a 9-year Air Force veteran and the founder of the group Survivors Take Action Against Abuse by Military Personnel. She'll be leading a workshop in Philadelphia on the weekend of June 27th at the National Organizing Conference, Stopping War Where It Begins, Organizing Against Militarism in Our Schools. Mackey spoke with Ingrid Drake of Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington, D.C. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons, taking the train to Tibet. And our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Benta Berkland and Keith Shaljian. Thanks to Pete Karakis, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. If you'd like to support Peace Watch, we urge you to make a pledge through our secure online website at pacifica.org, or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.